Let me just point out that everybody is so quick to ship JB, no matter who he's next to. Like, he stands next to Mariko in a scene, they're like, JB and Mariko. Stand next to Fuji for a scene, JB and Fuji. He stands next to Hiramatsu's wife for a scene, JB and Hiramatsu's wife. Let's go. Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're back for one final dip into the Shogun 2024, which I think is what I got to call it now. We're going to talk a whole boatload of feedback that we got on the ending of this series. We discussed a lot of it last time, but more came in afterward, addressing some of our points and just talking generally about feelings on the season. But I do know, Aaron, there's one thing before we get to that that you had said you wanted to talk about. What was that?
Oh, it's I'm actually going to throw you a huge curveball, because in the 10 seconds I was listening to you talk, it came up with another topic.
Oh, my God.
Because I want to tease. I want to give people a reason to keep listening. Jim and I are going to consider the 1980s version of Shogun. The copy that we're looking at is broken into four pieces of about 2.5 hours, which is interesting, because that's almost the exact same runtime of the FX 2024 version. I wanted to just say, like, because I know you and I both seen the first segment, the first act that goes all the way up through John Blackthorne being released from prison. That's kind of the cliffhanger. He's being called, his name's being called out of the prison. I'll just go for, I was worried, and I think I even said this on the podcast the other day, that like I saw the just the first 5 minutes of it, which is just essentially the character introductions, and I was worried. I was like, oh God, this looks very 80. This looks very cheesy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure this was going, it's like, oh my God, what if we watch the first one and it sucks? What was your, high or low, what's your opinion of the original 80s Shogun? With 25% of his runtime considered.
I mean, yeah, I can't talk about the whole thing, but I can say what I've seen so far, I was very impressed. Considering it was made in 1980, it was better than it had any right to be, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's very different. It's going to be, I think, really interesting to compare where they choose to focus their runtimes on and their approach. For example, none of the Japanese is translated unless... there's a translator there, or the narrator occasionally steps in, who I believe is Orson Welles, and that gives you kind of like just enough to know, but you're very much put in John Blackthorne's position of just being impenetrable, which I thought was, it was a very interesting choice, and I liked it, but it also certainly serves to put the Japanese characters in the foreground. They are
in the background,
NPCs to the main hero's quest. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that to be annoying, and I doubt I would have. Well, I don't want to get into a full podcast. We're about to do one. Generally, yeah, I liked it, but I do think it has several points with which, like, the new series is way better.
Yeah, but there's a couple things that I think I'm going to say I prefer the way the old one did it, now that I've seen them both. But I haven't read the book yet, so I think that's going to be a really interesting discussion that's going to unspool over the next 3 to 4 weeks. And if you want to kind of see, you know, the insights we glean from watching this older version, we'd love to have you with you. It's going to be here on this feed, the Bald Move Prestige feed. It'll be out. The first one will be out later this week, so stay tuned. Secondly, I think everything at the top of people's mind is, I know this is one book, there are no direct sequels, but what if we got more Shogun? There was an interview with the Hollywood Reporter with the two showrunners of the of Shogun, Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, where they're directly asked this. What is the what's going to happen in season two? And Mark says, I don't know. I keep saying it's like we want to let everyone be on the same page when it comes to the book, and hopefully now the TV audience and the book audience are on the same page with what the story is and where it resolves. I think if we had a story, if we could find a story, we'd be open to it. But I don't think that anyone ever wants to be out over their skis without a roadmap and everything. But it's also just about, do people want more of it? Obviously, the interviewer says, yeah, we've seen the results. We've seen the audience. The people want more Shogun. Mark says, but it's also about not even topping the book, but how do you even equal the roadmap to Clavel laid out? I don't know if it's possible. I don't know if Clavel could have done it either. It's probably why he moved on to other books too, right? He knew what he had done, and it's a tough one. They also asked him if he'd be interested in doing any of the other books in Asian Saga, you know, because we know that Clavel wrote a lot of books in that theater. And Mark says, oh gosh, I can only speak for myself reading Taipan right now, just apropos of nothing, honestly, and what a great book. Been telling Rachel about it as I've been reading and saying, well, he did it again. But it's also completely different. It's about Hong Kong in the early days, a totally different world, so it's not just playing the hits. He's conjuring new vivid characters that stand 75,000 feet tall all at once. And I think when you look at Shogun, that's part of what Clavel did. We were given these characters who were really so colorful and accessible, which is a hard magic to conjure as a novelist and a writer. What's your impression of these words? Is this someone that's like really honestly trying to find a way to do more Shogun, or is this a person who's rightly intimidated by trying to do a direct sequel to something that has no sequel?
I mean, I think it's the latter. I will say I don't know that. Here's the thing. I always want an artist to find an honest way into another story. I don't want this to be about money, because nothing that's ever made purely for money's sake is any good. So if they don't feel like there is a story there that needs to be told, they can't find it, then I don't want a second season to be made.
Because it can only, it can only.
It sounds like they're looking, but not looking hard, and that's probably the right way to go. Is you don't want to like try and squint at this thing from every angle and say, what could we possibly do here that would be in any way compelling, and just run with the first thing you come up with. You want them to wait until they feel some sort of inspiration for it, and then come back to it. And I don't think there's any real pressure to do this next year. I think the love for Shogun will still be there, and the appreciation for it, if they wait 3-4 years to do this. People will remember. They're not going to forget the show in a span of a few years.
No, I mean, 50 years has elapsed essentially between the book and the original TV show, and the love of, you know, the reputation of Shogun was still, I think, intact. I mean, that's the reason I'm like, shit, this is the thing that like my dad was obsessed with, and you know, all the adults loved him, and I got to check it out. I also think that they point out also in this interview that it took him 5 years from the inception of the idea to bring Shogun to the screen. And it's their opinion that they went and did like Taipan is what they're talking about, that deals with like China or Korea, all the infrastructure they built out to be experts at medieval Japan and get that like so.
Oh, yeah.
Would have to start over. Now, they probably wouldn't have to start all though, because they have a good production crew. But, you know, a lot of people are going to have to be replaced. A lot of people are going to have to be, you know, relearn a bunch of stuff. And, you know, they can't just do a Japanese version of Taipan. It's got to have the same impact. So it's I feel for him. It's intimidating to try to do a sequel that the author himself never felt, you know, the opportunity to get around to. And he had all the same pressures and all the same like, oh man, wouldn't it be? And Japanese history is what it is. It's not like it just stops happening here. So I'm not sure which I'd rather than do, like create a sequel out of whole cloth involving these characters like 10 years in the future or something, or adapting Clavel's other works that, you know, depart this geographically or like time spatially, you know, and in terms of time period. So, but
yeah,
if this is lightning we catch once in a bottle every 50 years, that's not a bad way to view art either.
That's fine. TV doesn't have to be all series, long running stuff. It can just be one and done stuff.
Yeah. That's a very clear focus story about the most exciting things happening. That's all I kind of had to talk about. I said most of what I said in our nearly 3-hour podcast last week. Yeah. So I'm curious to see us being cross-examined by the rest of the council.
All right, well, there's a little bit of cross-examination happening.
By the way, Shogun at baldmove.com if you want to send in feedback during our discussion of the classic miniseries. I'm not sure how much feedback we'll be considering, but it's still going to be open. And if you like what we're doing here, we'd appreciate your support, support.baldmove.com. shogun.com to get ad-free feeds and lots more bonus content. All right, now feedback.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This week, Jim's away, so the producer will play. That's right, it's time for another fabulous lunch with Talitha and Aaron. Not only do we have an alternate host lineup, we also are doing it on an alternate day. Lunch will be served on Wednesday. All that, plus the usual bullshit for me, served live, or catch the podcast version out later that day.
We're about a month out from the kickoff of Badass Fest 6, so get your tickets now while available at baldmove.com/live. Come watch an outrageously badass mystery film with us, grab another snack and beverage from the theater's fully stocked bar, then get back in your seat for a live recording of the accompanying podcast. Get more info and tickets at baldmove.com/live.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
All right, let's start off with Joel, who, you know, when one Bible doesn't get written, another person steps in to write another Bible. It's a long one, so stick with me.
He's the William Tyndale of the...
He's the Nate of the wrap-up this time. Joel says, so the series is wrapped, and I have invested a metric fuck-ton of time into this over the past 3 months. It's been absolutely enjoyable. This book has had a pretty large impact on me when I first read it back in high school in the late 90s. As you guys know, this was back in the infancy of the internet, and 17-year-old me wanted more and more of this story. I even went to my local library in search of VHS copies of the entire 1980 miniseries, only found a badly edited 2 to 3 hour version of the 9 hour long epic. Oh. What librarian was sitting there cutting together film?
I read this. This is a tragedy. When I was looking at the different versions, that there were a few cuts for the cinema, and I guess they were intended for international audiences for some reason, but everyone says they're just brutal. I mean, I don't think you could cut a good 2.5 hours out of this Shogun.
No. No, so, there's too much going on. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to feel like David Lynch's Dune or some shit like that.
Joel continues, going into this, I realized I now had been hoping for an exact representation of the details in the book. And this definitely set me up for a bit of disappointment initially, as the story unfolded in a different manner than it does in the book. Now that I've consumed all things related to Shogun over the last 3 months, every article and interview, the entire 1980 miniseries that I privateered from the Internet
Archive.
That's
right. There's an important legal distinction.
Even reread the entire book. I've come to appreciate what we got to see. When you look at it from a standpoint of where we started and where we ended up, we definitely got from point A to point B. Retrospectively, the book definitely puts Blackthorne on a pedestal and situationally sets him up to use his same intangible skill sets that allowed him to navigate from Europe to Japan. He does get a grasp of the culture and the customs very quickly. He definitely feels like a good example of when in Rome situation. Even with all that, in the end, he still thinks he still has the same ambition that he does in the beginning, but now everything is put into the appropriate perspective. The FX show definitely made some changes, but now that everything is sunk in, I genuinely like what they created. At the end of episode 10, we see we truly see a realization of a historical quote between Ieyasu Tokugawa and William Adams. It says, "William Adams is dead. I only see Mura Anjin." Mura was his fief granted by Tokugawa. Huh. Interesting. John Blackthorne died on that hill during his seppuku attempt, and Ajiro Anjin was born. The show will absolutely stand the test of time, and I will be rewatching the series annually for the next decade or so.
About right. I'm appreciating that this version of Shogun is kind of like a patched and updated version of the original. Like, you know, we now know these, you know, like James Clavell tried very hard to make an entertaining story out of what he knew of ancient Japan. Scholarship and cultural appreciation have progressed to the point that now we can do this story even better, shining more light into the interior of the Japanese so that, you know, their part of the story is being told a little bit better. And that's what it feels like to me. Like, this is the HD remaster version with extra dialogue and bonus scenes.
Yeah, I haven't read the book, but the way that they portray this in pretty much everything, every choice they made, especially when I contrast it with, you know, the stuff I've seen of the 1980 version, they've really taken a surgical, like a scalpel to this thing and said, what are the parts that we want to really resonate and kind of get everything else out of here? Let's spend time on that. And
yeah,
I think it paid off because, yeah, obviously it paid off. Everybody loves this series. Everybody who's seen
it. And I was also really gratified at how many scenes played essentially the exact same. So that there's a few that that really, really, especially, I don't want to say anymore. We got a whole other podcast to talk about that.
Joel has more to say.
Oh, okay.
He's got one more thing. Lastly, Aaron, I'm 1,000% with you in my head canon that Fuji stays with Blackthorne and they have cute little half children. It's like,
is that a slur? Is that a
No.
Is that a 17th century slur, Jim? Okay.
No, not to my knowledge. And I have a little bit of knowledge on it. It's not even a big stretch. The pieces are all there. On the surface, she intends to leave and become a nun, but after the events of last episode, she can't go through with it. She finally has closure on her loss after the burial at sea, and along with Blackthorne and Mariko's cross. They both get closure there. This, along with seeing how much Blackthorne has changed, has had a huge impact on her. Her desire to let go of the previous European ambitions and his compassion for the village. We live and we die. She will still think she is going to go and will just never leave. Then one night she'll go to him while he's laying down in the evening and the deed will get settled then and there.
It's just like the Dread Pirate Roberts. Every night she comes to his room and say, good evening, Blackthorne. Sleep well. It's most likely I'll be a nun in the morning. And then she just keeps staying around after breakfast. And Blackthorne's like, you know, starting to doubt that you're going to be you're doing this nun thing at all, Fuji-sama.
Yeah, she talks a big nun game, but we'll see.
And she, you know, we sure know she'd be the best, so there's no challenge to
her.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, trying to keep Blackthorn from possessing the kitchen with rotting pheasant carcass. That's a challenge right there.
There's this theory that when you are trying to achieve a goal, you should not tell your friends or family, anybody in your life, about it. Because once you tell them, you get the sort of rush that you get everything that you wanted out of accomplishing that goal without actually accomplishing the goal. And then you're far more likely to fail. So I think that's what she did. She told him, I'm going to become a nun. And next day she'll be like, I'm still planning on becoming a nun.
So awesome. You'll be the best nun. I can totally see you. And then you just get that little glow. I have not heard that social theory, but man, I kind of want to just turn Arista's podcast into an interrogation of that concept because I think it's fascinating. But we probably shouldn't. Probably should keep talking about Shogun.
If you want to read more about it, it's in a book called The Power of Habit. I forget the author's name, but it's a good book.
Oh, man. Think about all my long years of habits. Oh, boy. Professor WD says, Jim, I agree with you about the finale. I love the season of television. The acting was amazing. But I wanted more from the finale. I knew in advance that Ito becomes Tokyo, so assumed that somehow Toranaga would win. Same. But I wanted to see the establishment of Ito as the capital. At the same time, I've harbored a secret suspicion that the reason Ochiba hates Toranaga so much is that the Taiko and his wife made her sleep with Toranaga to get with the son. The mystery of his conception, given the Taiko's lack of heirs and numerous other women, was never resolved. This could also be why the Taiko's wife wants her to back Toranaga. He has the most incentive to protect the official heir. Is the reason that the Toranaga wants to maintain the peace among the regents to get his own son to the throne as peacefully as possible? Could be. I think that is an interesting theory that doesn't have a lot of textual support. Keep in mind, I haven't read the book and I haven't seen the miniseries, so if there are any hints to this, I'm speaking out of ignorance, but...
Yeah, it's a shame you're agreeing with me about the finale, because the more I'm thinking about the finale, the more I'm liking it. I do still think that they had prepared me to want a lot more action-wise from that finale. The more I think about the way they ended it and the things that they were trying to do with it, I'm starting to come around. Not that I was against it last podcast we did. It's just like there were a couple of glaring things that I wanted to see that I never got to see, so...
Yeah, this week on Lunch, someone asked us about, by the way, Lunch Premium Podcast, support.baldmove.com, about sometimes we say, on second watch, on first watch, I was kind of or kind of meh, or kind of didn't like it. But on subsequent watches, I started to, and we're kind of put on a spot and we're trying to explain like why and how. And I think we did an okay job. But the other thing is like what you just said about expectations.
Yeah.
Is what really kills you. That when you got in your heart that like, oh man, we're gonna see this battle and Toranaga's gonna whip off Ishido's head and everybody's gonna cheer, and not seeing that is like waking up thinking that you got the bike that you wanted on your birthday and realizing it was just a dream. Like no matter how good your life is, for those seconds what you're dealing with, the loss of an imagined thing you never had can be take an emotional toll. But the other thing I've really thought about since the last episode is the end of this series works as kind of like a sick rebuke that Toranaga gave to his son. Like, why is it the ones that have never seen battle seem so eager to be in one? I've never been in a fight that has more than two participants in it. I've never been like put in mortal danger with weaponry on a battlefield. And I feel that like we wanted to see, but that's what anyone can do. We got to see what only Toranaga could do, tie up the court in knots, you use the law of Japan, like a guerrilla warrior uses the forest for cover, as he takes pot shots at the main army. And I increasingly am satisfied with that. And I do think it is it is unfortunate, in the exact same way it was unfortunate that some of the allusions to season one True Detective really interfered with people's ability to enjoy the latest season. It's kind of unfortunate that they set the framework of that episode with the dream within a dream. Because of course people got the wrong message, and there's another layer of, oh, what the fuck? But all in all, I feel really good about how this ended.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't have many complaints. I still would have really liked to see that battle, but what are you gonna do?
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, I guess real history, which you can't use to disprove or prove anything on the show. Real history, if you read what happens in the next decade or two, kind of undercuts a lot of what you're saying in this email. But if they did do Shogun 2, maybe they would go with one of these, you know, more counterfactual historical examples, or just continue to just like, what if, you know, there's no rule against that.
All right. Well, let's see what Melanie has to say. She writes in, I'd like to revisit the purpose or lack thereof of Hiramatsu's death. Oh, boy. Here we go. As an audience, we clearly see how Mariko's death moved the plot and Toranaga's plans forward. She went in and essentially checkmated Ishido and sowed dissent among the ruling class families, essentially allowing them to leave Ishido's non-hostage situation and expose his weakness. While we were all sad to see her die, at least her death meant something. When I apply that same cost-benefit analysis to Hiramatsu's death, I come up short. I know that we were all told that he needed to commit seppuku in order to convince Ishido supporters that Toranaga had truly given up. But did that ruse even come close to working? The only scene that addressed the success of this plan was between Father Alvito and Monsignor Dell'Acqua, in which Dell'Acqua literally tells Alvito that he's a fool if he believes that Hiramatsu's seppuku was any proof that Toranaga was finished, and is never shown or addressed again. Even when Mariko responds to Ishido's question about Toranaga's progress, she only references he is mourning the death of his son, and nothing about Hiramatsu. And while I appreciated the masterclass and face acting that was put on display in that seppuku scene, I don't think it added anything to the overall narrative and was a poor decision in the writer's room. This is interesting. I was thinking about this scene because I kind of sort of touched on that last time. Was it ultimately in vain? Like, did Hiramatsu's death contribute in any way to the actual plan that Toranaga had going?
It's complicated, and I'll also say that, whenever you're looking at something in history, there is always the, like, oh, this is the linchpin thing, you know, like what it's like when you drop the bomb on Nagasaki, or when you invaded France at Normandy, and everyone thinks is like, oh, if this went different, then everything could have been different. And it's likely that one, the pivotal change we see is only pivotal in hindsight, because it was the culmination of a bunch of efforts. And if that effort had failed, then others would have succeeded, or maybe something could have succeeded before then that would have made that effort unnecessary. And I think that if you analyze the death of Hiramatsu as only like, did it trick Ishido? I don't know, because it seems like it did kind of put Ishido into more of like, hey, I'm going to plan my marriage and just assume everything's good, and, you know, we can go on to bigger things, and distracted him a little bit. One of the other intended things was to keep Toranaga. Mm-hmm. It's also keep Toranaga's men in line, that they were about, like, he wanted to, you know, continue to play this ruse and let his enemies, you know, underestimate him, and his generals were pressuring him into going, you know, into war, and he didn't want that. But he also could not come out and say, it's not what I want, because he was justifiably worried about the spies. So to me, it's a tragedy that he wanted one of his generals to commit seppuku. He did not want it to be Hiramatsu, but he's there in this horns of dilemma, because if he says, okay, fine, it's not that serious, then he gives up the game, and, you know. So but again, it's like if Hiramatsu hadn't committed suicide and he had backed down, you know, I think Toranaga had a path to win. If one of his other generals had killed himself, obviously. If all of his generals just kept silent and just trusted in the Lord, it would, you know, it's like there's a lot of different ways he could have won. And that's what I keep coming back to. But yeah. But I also agree that, like, the Portuguese-Spanish plot is extremely underdeveloped. And I'm getting that just in the first segment of the old 1980s. There's far more time spent on not just the Portuguese and Spain, but the fact that they're an alliance, and that alliance has some fractures. Mm-hmm. And some jealousies and rivalries within it too. It's not just like a monolith. And I think that just stuff is just absent from this new adaptation. I wonder if they shouldn't have just adapted that a little bit further. And you know, you only see Brother Martin or Father Martin, because it just feels like a branch. It feels like a withered branch that didn't grow. You know,
it is. Yeah, I mean, and that's also the true of Hiramatsu's death. I think, you can say, OK, well, he needed a general to commit seppuku in order to keep his generals, you know, doing what he wanted them to do. That may be true. But I think there's this, like, there's the concept of the red herring, right, which is traditionally in a narrative, it's a intentional dead end. For its story, like, this is something you should be looking at. Aha, it didn't matter. This is sort of that, except they're doing it to a point to say something about Torunaga. And that's where I eventually came around on this. I started thinking, okay, why are they doing this? If this is a red herring, essentially, and it's going to lead nowhere, why do it at all? Wouldn't it be better if they just cut it out of the show? Well, no, because when you look at what Torunaga says about his, I guess, mode of operation, it's, I don't control the wind. I simply read it. And this is part of him reading the wind, right? He's not trying necessarily, he's trying to do what he can to control the wind. You know, he's saying, okay, well, I can direct it over here a little bit. I'm not the master of the wind, but I can push it in this direction. And oh, it didn't quite work out how I wanted there. But, you know, it'll present other opportunities because then, you know, Mariko can go there.
I deflected the wind 15% instead of 30 the way. But now where do I need to be to catch it?
And I think if you had him being the mastermind at all times, who was perfectly in control of everything, if there weren't some of these red herrings or dead ends in a narrative where things just don't work out the way he wants, you'd risk him just coming off as this mastermind who is actually in control of the wind. It's not the point they're trying to make. So I do think it has its place in here, even though it's hard to see that there was any point to it whatsoever in the end. Because I agree, it ultimately proved to be basically pointless.
And the other thing is, you know, if you want this nonviolent ending to pay off, it is important, as we mentioned last episode, for Torunaga to have made sacrifices that meant things to him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone can argue that losing his son, you know, losing his best friend's daughter, losing his mentor, his father figure, like he did suffer, and those things did cost him, you know. Mm-hmm. Like those deaths he felt, and that's why even though people might feel like, oh god, I wish I'd seen him victorious on the battlefield, you did have that kind of emotional sacrifice, that hero's journey of him, you know, doing all these things and sacrificing and even letting himself be changed by the people around him. And I think that's what these things all go together to make the anticlimactic ending, which is faithful to the book, work, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough story. It's a tough note they're trying to hit.
Yes.
Especially agreed. With Torunaga, that I think they did a really good job in the end.
And I'll say that's... more often than not, that's the way a lot of Patrick O'Brien books end too. The ones that I really like, the Master and Commander, if you've seen the Russell Crowe movie, a great many of his books end right at the climax of action. Like, you know, the disposition of the battle and how it's going to go. And then the book ends with the first cannon shot. Because Patrick O'Brien's like, yeah, I've already written three fucking sea battles that lasted 45 pages. What do you want from me? And number two, he's like, you know what's going to happen. The Jack's plan's going to go off without a hitch and he's going to win. So it's like sometimes that is a sublime kind of satisfaction of ending things and the author trusting you to know that he doesn't have to do it again. You can just use your imagination. And then the next book, you'll find out that how things went or if there was a setback, what the new adventure is. So maybe I was a little primed to accept that more than other people, even though, again, I had no idea mm-hmm. Shogun was going to end this way.
Yeah.
David Sensei says, Torunaga talks of studying the wind as a way to achieve his goals. This is literally Blackthorn's job as the pilot of a sailing ship. Torunaga always refers to Blackthorn as Anjin, never by his name. One of his hearts, does Torunaga see himself as the Anjin of Japan? If this is an unspoken connection known only to Torunaga, which keeps Blackthorn alive and interesting to this otherwise ruthless man, an amazing show. I think any reasonable person could, if you want to make this analogy, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know that Torunaga actually sees himself that way, but we certainly could look at him that way.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, I don't think that's the only job of a pilot. You also have to know where the reefs are, and you know there's a lot more to it than, you know, you got to know what's going on under the ocean as much as what's going on in the sky. But yeah, I think it makes a compelling subtextual argument.
All right, let's go to Henry, who says, not sure if you guys noticed this, but pretty sure I didn't hear you point this out, but did you know that Ferreira, the captain of the Black Ship, is played by none other than Louis Ferreira? I'm assuming their names matching is just a big coincidence. That happens sometimes in TV. I really like when that happens. You know what? I like the little connections there that aren't really connections, but sort of work out interestingly. Like, the fact that you have in Star Trek The Next Generation a captain named Picard, and then in Voyager you have a man named Robert Picardo playing another character in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but those are always fun little nuggets for me to chew on.
Yeah, I like those when someone shares the same first name or whatever. And that's not anyone is intentionally. Like, a lot of comedy shows are named after, and he's got a different last name for some stupid reason. But I don't. Was this the guy? Was this the guy that Heisenberg said you're goddamn right to? It's Declan.
Looks like him. Is it Declan?
Yes, he was Declan in Breaking Bad for 3 episodes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, that's where I saw him. Okay. Okay.
Huh.
Jamie H. says, check your local library for the 1980s miniseries on DVD if you don't want to purchase it or be a privateer. My library system has it, and the hold queue is fairly short compared to the one for the book. Holy shit, the book queue. I wonder if Cincinnati Public Library get two new books. Did I bitch about this the last time on the podcast? Because I went to go buy it on Kindle. I know for a fact this thing was like $2.99 a year ago, and you could get for one. They've made a Shogun edition where they split it into two, and each one's $7.99 on ebook.
Of course.
Capitalism, baby. And yeah, my local library in Cincinnati only has 2 copies, and there's a hojillion people waiting for it. So the heat death of the universe will arrive before it's available, apparently. Anyway, in this age of streaming, things disappear and reappear at random. Your local library is a great resource for physical media, especially for older series films. True, especially when so many are getting held up on streaming rights because of music things. Like, the first time I came across that is like, what was it, 2 years ago when we did Pump Up the Volume? And that shit was literally impossible to stream and largely unavailable on Blu-ray because it used, the entire runtime is the radio, the rebellious punk radio of the day. And that shit had streaming rights. So a lot of stuff is disappearing. Many libraries use apps. Mine uses Hoopla, which lets you rent digital movie shows for free with your library card. This ends my please utilize your local library PSA.
I do. It's great. It's an amazing service that everybody should be using.
Yeah, dude. Discovering Libby and its integration with my Kindle was a life changer. I will say that I haven't really dipped my toe into things beyond like books and audiobooks.
Same here. Yeah. I know they sometimes have video games also.
There's a lot of stuff. I mean, you can book time on 3D printers in Cincinnati. There's
vinyl cutters, all kinds of things.
There's a lot to your library card, and if you're like, what's this about Kindle? Yeah, like there's this app called Libby where you just scan your library card and you can just put in holds and it automatically tells you when it's available. It syncs automatically to your Kindle, or if you've got it's got a built-in audiobook reader. It's really impressive. And it just completely changed my reading habit, so check it out. Jamie says, Aaron continues, I'd like to and your alt universe John Blackthorne Yabu pirate adventure series, if I may. Imagine Blackthorne, Yabushige, and Rodriguez having sailing adventures on the high seas. Stop! I can only get so erect. You just added Rodriguez to this mix. Holy shit.
I'm gonna have to see a doctor.
Lightheaded. The shenanigans these three could get up to would be endlessly watchable. Episode 1 of the series, they volunteer to escort Fuji to her temple, only for her to realize on the way that she'd rather hang out with the three of them than become a nun. Oh my god! Okay. Now we shippers can have the JB Fuji content we really want. Somebody write this One Piece style Age of Sail Pirate Adventure series, please. I don't want the official version of Shogun 2. I want this version.
Let me just point out that everybody is so quick to ship JB, no matter who he's next to. Like, he stands next to Mariko in a scene, they're like JB and Mariko. Stand next to Fuji for a scene, JB and Fuji. He stands next to Hiramatsu's wife for a scene, JB and Hiramatsu's wife. Let's go. Why? Why are we so quick? Can't they just be friends?
Why are we leaving out the men is what I'm wanting to know.
Fair.
JB and Hiramatsu's wife? No. JP and the Iron Fist? Yes.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not going to get any work done now. Thank you. Thank you, Jamie. I was just going to be obsessed with this idea.
I like this point from Frank. Ironically, in his dream life back in England, the king would have been Catholic.
Is this true? Or is this a subtlety of Catholicism I missed?
Was there
a papa sitting on the throne of England? My God, the shame of it.
In the period between like when he was in Japan and 40 years later or whatever, when he was an old man?
I'm not aware, but honestly, a lot of my knowledge of the England stuff starts in the late 1700s. So I fucking don't. I find that highly surprising given the attitudes of the common man depicted in a lot of literature I've read around 1800s. It was very much, the Roman Catholics versus the Protestants. Cincinnati Joe says, were you surprised that there wasn't an indication at the end of the fate of Torunaga, Blackthorn, or Japan, either the characters or the real life equivalents? I thought there might be cards briefly summarizing that Blackthorn never returns to England, Torunaga becomes shogun, and the country enters its most peaceful period. I'm a little surprised too.
Yeah.
You know how the end of like the Gangsters of New York ends, where it shows the 5 points borough and then it kind of like rapidly ages and you see modern America around it, and how it would be very cool for Torunaga to like look over his in construction Edo and to pull out and see that become modern day Tokyo. And that's all you would have to do. But it's almost like the showrunners, Rachel Kondo and Mark Sparks, almost like they wanted you to go to Wikipedia, they wanted you to crack a book, they wanted you to educate yourself, because it's just like, yeah, it's like left a mystery almost.
Joke's on them, I'm not doing any of that.
That's right, we're Americans. I don't know what the hell country you thought you were making entertainment for, but
right.
Yeah
Let's go over to RCM, who is doing a little mea culpa here. He says, I was listening to your last episode. I was thinking to myself, I hope they don't read my email. Your analysis made me question some of my conclusions. Rewatching part of the episode again, you guys were, of course, right. Torunaga did stop the killings. I clearly lost face with that one. I was about to commit seppuku because of the shame when I heard a voice say, hold your horses. The voice had a vague Kentucky accent. Anyway, I rewound to the scene with Fuji, and JB. She didn't actually ask him for advice. She simply said she didn't know what to do. Traditionally, she would have buried the ashes with the rest of her family. I'll split that one down the middle because it could be implied that she was asking for help. As for Yabu's breakdown, although I still don't think that Mariko's death would have had that great an effect on a man who boils people alive, your analysis makes sense. There are a few things that aren't consistent with the story being told, though. Torunaga, he's going back in. He's taking a second shot.
Uh-oh.
See how it works out.
Split in the middle to ultimate victory. We'll see how it goes.
Torunaga sure goes through a lot and concedes a lot. For example, sparing the villagers for a person who's supposed to just make him laugh and isn't that material to his plans. Even reveals Muraji as a spy to JB. That's huge for a notably secretive person. When Torunaga saves JB from committing seppuku, I think you see it that there is more to this than a lord saving his favorite jester. The cross was JB's last link with Mariko, and he let it go. Maybe JB is Torunaga's last link with Mariko, and he simply can't allow himself to throw that away. That's what makes sense in my mind. I think it was Aaron who mentioned that it would be a bit of a conceit to think that Torunaga would consider JB a friend like he does in the book. I may agree with that. However, as a last link to someone who he truly valued, respected, and possibly loved, I think there's something more that Torunaga may not be willing to admit to himself, or at least to Yabu. keep that inner heart hidden, Lord Tornaga. What do you think about that? So, that Blackthorn is kind of probably the person who was closest with Mariko, and he, Tornaga, is keeping him around because of that.
I think it's plausible. And I think that, like, if we look at the real life historical counterparts to JB and Tornaga, I think by the end of their, you know, lives, that they probably were what I would consider friends. But this is the very beginning of their relationship. And, and also, like, I'm sure the book and the 80s show, already in what I've seen in the 80s show, it looks like that they're signaling that there's going to be more, like, warmth and equality between the two men see each other as equals more than in this series. But, yeah, I don't know. I also think that, like, it's not so much that Tornaga wants him here, but I don't think Blackthorn wants to leave anymore either. Like, Japan has... Yeah. Has permanently changed who he is and how he relates to his country, his religion, his philosophy, himself. Sucks for
what's he gonna go
orphans, but
he's gonna go back home and the Dutch are gonna be like, so what'd you get up to over there? You got our riches? No, okay, well, I guess pilot a whole bunch more ships over there and let's get the trade going again. I mean, he can't go back to his old way of life. It's just not possible for him.
Yeah, it's ruined, like, that freedom of the open seas that he sought, he got it, like the ultimate version. And
it's free of
he
himself,
now
right?
Sees, yeah, he now sees the folly of that. You know, like, that his life has never had more meaning than it has in this last year, half year or so. And getting on the ground floor and building something better with somebody. I could see how that would appeal and really satisfy one's sense of, like, accomplishment. And because that's what usually ambition is. It's just wanting to be useful, wanting to make your mark. You know, and it's a damn shame we don't have better value than currency a lot of the time to reward that for people, because we're probably failing to harness a lot of potential here.
And RCM goes on here. By the way, Blackthorn's Japanese has waxed and waned throughout the series. The seppuku speech is complex, at least the translation is. Seems that he has a pretty good command of the language at times, and at other times, just passing. One last thing, as I listened to Aaron's comments about the original miniseries, I started feeling bad for you guys. Haven't seen it in a very long time, but I have flashes of bad wigs and makeup in mind for some reason. I hope I'm wrong. One thing I will say is that it would be very hard for the actor in the original series to hold up to the most recent version of Yabu. I think that actor did a great job. Anyway, gorgeous series, great callbacks to the final episode. If you ever make Toranaga's Brothers Robes merch, please let me know.
I don't know if we could afford it, Jesus. That was silk. No. And I need two to fit my frame.
Yeah. Well, you should check out the podcast that we're going to have out later this week, where we talk about the 1980s series. Because, yeah, I do have a lot of comments on those two things in particular.
Yes, sir. I'll say this. It's not as bad as you fear from your memories, but it's also not as good as you're hoping.
Yeah.
This was a 1980s television miniseries. They spent a lot of money on location and cast, so it's a lot of, you know, I what's the cheapest material that you can make? It's like it's muslin. Thank you. There's a lot of taupe muslin, a lot of badly tailored taupe muslin in this show.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe!
Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Mare's up next says, hey fellas, listening to your newest recap of the finale, and I'm sure someone has already mentioned this to you, but Shogun 1980 is actually on archive.org. Well, yeah. Not legally, probably, but it is up there.
It's available. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, going into that 1980 series, there were a lot of people who wrote in to tell us they could find it on archive.org. So, yeah, it's the best place to watch it, probably.
I think it's a non-piratey way to watch. What does this mean? Like, non-piratey?
I mean,
archive.org does not have a permission to host these files. They just do it. They just are they're a self-appointed Library of Congress for the internet.
I don't know what the status of archive.org is, and Wikipedia and the Wayback Machine and all these organizations that sort of collate culture like that. Because I know clearly some exceptions in copyright exist, and I don't know if they have carved out an exception for archive.org as like an official repository for all of that stuff. And that anything that's up there is legal by definition, but it's a way to watch it.
That's the case. Yeah.
It's a way to watch it.
Yeah. I will say that unlike many other places where you can privateer, there's no danger of getting a virus or downloading a wrong file, or like archive.org is very legit and it's, you know, in that sense of the word.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to, you know, have 50 million download buttons and only one is the holy grail. The others are the false grail that will consume your system memory and crash your hard drive. Yeah. But it also sucks. The quality is pretty god awful. I did view it, and the Blu-ray transfer I'm looking at is way better. Says also, to fill any sort of Shogun void, I highly recommend the series Girl/Haji on Netflix. It has our guy Ishido Takahiro Hira in a very different role as a timid but fierce family man and detective. Also features Kelly MacDonald, Anna Sawai, and some really talented Japanese actors you may recognize. Highly recommend. That's interesting. I did start watching Age of the Samurai. I got through the first episode. That deals with the first warlord. What is that guy's name?
Nobunaga? Kurunda, huh? Nobunaga. Thank you. See, these names were really tough for me. And it was fun when Nate showed up. Nate Ledbetter shows up. I'm like, holy shit, it's him.
Yeah, go check that out.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it feels more like reading Fire and Blood, you know? Like watching Shogun was watching House of the Dragon, and watching Age of Samurai is very much like Fire and Blood, where the acting and the costume and all that stuff, the sets are just enough to, you know, get a good bust to go with the figurehead, the historical figure they're talking about, and the battles and all that. It's like it feels like a history documentary more than a narrative fiction, but that's okay because I think that stuff is really interesting too. But thanks for the recommendation.
Let's roll into another recommendation here. It's our final email. James in California writes in, it's just a quick comment. Have you guys ever played Ghost of Tsushima? What are your guys' thoughts? Just got down to finally start playing it, and with just watching Shogun, I feel that I am enjoying the game more. I know there's a time difference with both, but getting to enjoy playing as a samurai and seeing the culture made me enjoy the game and the show more. I did not play Ghost of Tsushima.
I didn't either, but I watched my wife Cecily play approximately 30 hours of it over the course of her. She beat the original game, and then I believe there's an expansion that she also beat and really loves it. And she just watched all of Shogun in the last 3 days and was constantly telling me, "It's like, oh my God, I loved it when they went to the steam baths." And I look, because, you know, that's all. I know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to reflect on haiku. So apparently it is very satisfying if you are into both universes. If I were not utterly consumed by Helldivers, I would spin this thing up and play it probably. But alas, I'm still watching more Shogun.
Yeah, right.
All right, that's where we're going to end things for, not this week, actually. We'll have another episode out later in the week that talks about this first installment of the miniseries. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing four parts, if you're keeping along with one other version. Like I said, we're watching right up until John Blackthorne is released from prison. If you want to follow along on our 1980 saga, check it out. Just stay subscribed to this feed. If you like what we're doing, really encourage you to subscribe to the Bald Move Prestige feed, because all of our award-winning best of television goes here. If you want to interested in what we think about sci-fi, comic book stuff, zombies, dragons, things like that, you can check out Bald Move Pulp. If you subscribe to both, you essentially get the entirety of what we do. And if you still want more, holy cow, you madman, support.baldmove.com is how you get access to ad-free feeds as well as other special features like our off-the-clock conversations about everything we're not talking about on official podcast, as well as Lunch with Jim and Aaron, tons of other stuff. Check it out, support.baldmove.com. That's going to do it for us on Shogun for this episode. Stay tuned for our coverage of the 1980s miniseries. Follow us on all social medias at Bald Move. Until the next time we talk again, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.